I chose the subject of burnout to talk about because it seemed to me it was a very important subject for us in our busy lives, and particularly important for Christian audiences to think about. Now, some people believe that Christians shouldn't have problems and illnesses and disorders and all that sort of thing. I frankly happen to believe that we are particularly prone to certain kinds of problems if we are committed Christians. And this is one of those themes that I think is particularly a problem for Christians. So my background is that I come as a practicing psychologist from a practice which I set up 5 years ago to have a particularly Christian orientation and to work with people within Christian guidelines. And some of the people who come to us are themselves Christians, but by no means all. But something I've seen a lot of over the last few years that we've been working have been people who present with this new disorder, which we call burnout. I say new because the concept is relatively new to professionals, but it's very old in reality, though I think we're seeing a lot more of it in recent years than used to be the case. I'll keep fairly closely to some notes and some overhead transparencies, partly for your sake, to guide you through so I don't get lost and leave you on an evening when I think in the evenings it's not all that easy to stay with the theme. Partly also for the sake of the microphone so that the people listening on a tape won't get lost in the wanderings of my mind. So I'll try and stay fairly tightly with some material that I've prepared for you. Let me first of all give you a couple or three questions from an article which was written for Christians working in helping areas, and that might identify a few of you. It says, are you busier than ever in Christian service but accomplishing little and enjoying it less? Do you feel depleted and fatigued instead of energetic, beset with physical ailments that won't go away? Are you increasingly irritable, disillusioned with people, often difficult to deal with, feeling more and more detached, even from close Christian friends? Has the joy of the Lord given way to melancholy and a malaise you somehow can't explain? If you recognize some of those questions as fitting you, then burnout may be close to you. Chances are that if you don't recognize it within yourself, you will know one or two people of your acquaintance for whom it fits painfully well. But let me add also, the danger warning is that when we're heading towards this strange disorder, we're usually the last to recognize it. And so somebody else is more likely to recognize it in you than you are to recognize it in yourself. So from the point of view of caring for one another, it's important for us to understand it as fully as possible so that we can alert friends, colleagues, acquaintances to what may be happening to them so they don't get too far into it without being aware that something needs attention. Who gets burnout? Well, particularly it was first diagnosed and recognised amongst the broad collection of people called people helpers. Those who reach out to help one another either on a professional daily basis, like school teachers, nurses, doctors and other helpers, or non-professionally, and the biggest group I think of immediately is mums, who are giving of themselves for the benefit of others and find that they just get exhausted in the kind of way I've described. When there's very little relief, when there's overwork, and particularly if there's underpay, people are at risk for burnout. When the stress goes on and on without relief, there's the risk there may be burnout. If you're one of those particularly busy and energetic and vigorous and competent people who everybody admires and says, I wish I could be like that, how have they got the energy for all that work? You're probably a good risk for burnout. And if you're a Christian with all those attributes, or even an assortment of those attributes, you're especially at risk. Let me quote again. Ironically, Christian believers are especially susceptible to burnout. This is true for a number of reasons. First, the possibility of burnout exists only where there is fire. The fire goes out. Freudenberger, who is the American guy who first developed the phrase in the recent professional literature, Herbert J. Freudenberger, you might guess he was an American, has noted that, to quote, anyone who enters this world with a vision, as the individual with a burnout temperament does, the actuality of burnout is shocking. And Christians, of course, come into this world and work through our experience of having a vision. Our vision of Christian service must square with the reality of God's will and human circumstances. If it doesn't, the results can be not only shocking, but shattering. Christians are also particularly susceptible to burnout because of our typically idealistic and sometimes perfectionistic aspirations and high expectations. Furthermore, the work ethic ingrained in our Orthodox religious background makes it difficult for many Christians to relax and enjoy pleasurable recreation without feeling guilty. Even on an Easter holiday, you have to turn out to serious talks when many a non-Christian have been doing much more fun things than that. And so we do have a sense in which we are at risk and in danger of getting ourselves into troubles. Now, I don't know what backgrounds you various people come from, but for those who are in leadership positions, let me just mention that I've got in front of me an article from the magazine called Leadership, 1984, which is called The Danger of Aiming Too High. Does that sound a strange injunction to Christians? Beware of aiming too high. I have here a whole magazine, a whole issue of the Fuller Theological Seminary Notes and News, a magazine entitled Burnout, which was entirely addressed to pastors and to missionaries, to particularly at-risk groups. I have here a copy of a medical magazine, a beautiful picture in colour. I'll show it to you in black and white and colour so you can savour both. That's the title, Is Stress Screwing Up Your Life? And that's suggesting that ways of dealing with it are through various kinds of vitamins, but that's only one way of dealing with things. But there's, as I saw it first in glorious colour, I thought that just expressed how I feel sometimes, really twisted up under the impact of stress. Many of us feel that way from time to time. Perhaps you might appreciate this little picture of a chap who's been working particularly hard. Pastor Jones is on his way on the stretcher, and the little daughter says, is Daddy a saint now, Mummy? As he goes off saying, I did it, I filled every date in my diary. I'm a success! Exit to the psychiatric hospital. Do you know people like that? I do. They start off being called workaholics. And if you're not one of those, you don't know what I'm talking about, but some of you, I suspect, do. So what are we talking about? Burnout. It means, technically, to deplete yourself. Just to run out of resources and energy, having been up and going and fire in the belly, seemingly everything has burned out. To exhaust mental and physical resources, to wear yourself out by excessively striving, that is, striving too hard, to reach some unrealistic expectation imposed either by yourself or by the values of society. And your society may be the Christian group, which seems to expect great things of you all the time. Not just sometimes, but all the time. Some of us perhaps in the past were inspired by the great missionaries who seemed to enthuse with the idea of getting burned out. And indeed, many people I've heard have quoted missionaries like Henry Martin with approval as being those who've been the models for missionary work. You may remember his famous words. In 1812, he died at the age of 31 in Persia, and he wrote, I feel pressed in spirit to do something for God. I've hitherto lived to little purpose, more like a clod than a servant of God. Let me burn out for God. And my reading of Henry Martin was not that he was much of a clod. He was a pretty hard worker for God. But he saw himself as that way and wanted to burn out for God. And many missionaries have said, that's my desire, to go out and burn out for God. It sounds a great idea, but it isn't necessarily God's way for you. It may have been for Martin. It may not. It may have been his workaholism. or whatever it was, we should not necessarily assume that that's the way we ought to go, as if it were in some way virtuous. Listen to Peter Wagner. Some of you may know him. He was a colleague of mine when I was teaching at Fuller Seminary. He's still there and he's known for his church growth books. And he talks about work, and then he links work with pride. Nasty word, that. Pride, he says. Well, work may not be called a sin in the Bible, but pride certainly is. Wasn't I proud of propelling myself out of bed and getting into high gear at 4:30 every morning? Wasn't I proud that whilst my neighbours were sleeping at 5 a.m., imagine, I was out in the street running a mile? Wasn't I proud of the number of books and articles I could get published in a year? Wasn't I proud of my ability to bring work home and continue through the evening with only a brief interruption for dinner? Wasn't I proud of foregoing holidays year after year so I could produce more? Wasn't I proud of the number of miles I could travel and speaking engagements I could handle without a break? Wasn't I proud of dictating stacks of letters on aeroplanes and shipping the cassettes home to my secretary? Wasn't I proud that when I land in some exotic country, I'd invariably choose to work rather than take in the tourist attractions? And of course I could go on, he says. Some of you recognize that lifestyle. I remember it. I've been like that. I've done those things, pretty well all of them. Peter Wagner was brought up in his tracks by getting a severe headache that he says lasted for 70 days and 70 nights. And then eventually God spoke to him through a psalm, and he came to realize that it was time he changed gear and behaved a little more sensibly. So that's something of the background to how people get towards burnout. It's the end point or near end point of a state of chronic stress which people have experienced and not done anything about. Let me go through some of the features of what we're thinking about, some of the ways we deal with it, some of the symptoms that people like myself look for, and then some of the ways in which we may deal with it. Then finally, hopefully, I'd like to give you a list of things that you might be able to do in order to prevent yourself getting it, rather than having to simply recover from it. These notes I've prepared and used with various groups, particularly those in the helping profession, so you may find one or two little bits here and there look a little odd to you. Mostly they will be more relevant to a medical audience than to yourselves, but I think the parallel goes across to most of us who are in some way in some helping relationship. First of all, a straight definition is that burnout is, among other things, a chronic stress syndrome. That is, it's something which is built up and goes on and has recognisable features which distinguish it from other kinds of disabling conditions. And it's characterised by an erosion of spirit, and it classically affects people who are truly dedicated and enthusiastic. And that's one of the sad things about it, really. People have been absolutely terrific are the people who seem to be hit worst by it. It's characterised by being in a state of fatigue or frustration brought about by devotion to a cause, a way of life, or a relationship that fails to provide the expected rewards. Those are the features which were first identified by Dr. Benson back in 1982. Now, how do we deal with it? Interpersonally, we cope with the world by distancing ourselves a little. We can't handle day-to-day close personal relationships we've been accustomed to. So doctors in that situation engage in what they call by-the-book treatment. Sign the script, get them out of the surgery, up and away. I don't want to know anything more about patients. The fewer I have, the better. And we see it in various professional situations. We see it with parents and children. Get them out of my hair. I can't stand them another minute. I'll murder them if they appear. And similar friendly phrases that we might say about our beloved children. By actually avoiding contact with people, not wanting to see them, if we do see them, spending short times, but preferably not seeing them at all. And it goes off into social relationships as well. People have been sociable and enjoyed contact with people, avoid going to church, avoid being invited out, don't accept dinner invitations, and so on. Shortening the amount of time we spend with people, and labelling them in a derogatory way. Most doctors have quite a strong relationship to their patients after a while. When they start talking about them like, oh, here's another case of, or here's patient number so-and-so, you know they're engaging in a kind of derogatory labelling bit. It goes off into other areas of our lives if we get stuck like this, and the common areas which show up are that people often move into the unwise use of drugs or alcohol, and very commonly, and I may say that both of those apply to Christian people I've worked with, it's not just non-Christians who get stuck with those two problems, and very much so also that third one of family disharmony. Often the family suffers burnout before the individual does. They suffer the pain and distress and wonder what's hitting them, not realising the syndrome that's creeping up on the person who's suffering. I will largely speak as if I were talking about a man, because mostly that is where it first showed up. But I'm finding increasingly in my practice that I'm talking about women who also have the similar problems more and more. What would we be looking for? Well, fairly obviously, depression. By the way, if you want to think about a biblical example to get an idea of what it's like to suffer burnout, probably the best example that I know of is in 1 Kings 19. Dear old Elijah, having done great things in relation to the prophets of Baal, then comes to believe that Queen Jezebel is after him to kill him, and generalizes from that feeling of alienation from the queen to say to God, "Everybody is against me." And he goes off into the mountains to a cave. You'll perhaps recall the story of 1 Kings 19, where he leaves his servant and goes off into a cave and spends time far away from everybody. And boy, is he depressed. In fact, he tells God that it would really be the very best thing that could happen if he could die, rather like Jonah. So depressed mood is absolutely central and characteristic. No more joy in life, distinctly down. Irritability, good reason for avoiding people. If you're with people, you're a pain. Constantly irritated by the tiniest things. Very oversensitive. High level of anxiety. Rushing around trying to cope with things and sort out the mess and doing it very unsuccessfully and becoming increasingly anxious that things are not working out well. Rigidity. And people have been typically creative and flexible and such things. They find increasingly they can't deal with things the way they used to, so they settle to narrower and narrower and familiar ways of doing things. A pastor who is burned out is a pain to his congregation. He does everything to the book and does it the way he's always done it, and any suggestion of change or departure would be absolutely anathema. Has to do it just like that, and don't let's deviate one bit. Negativism. That's the assumption that things are not going to work out well. Subscription to Murphy's Law. If things will go wrong, if things can go wrong, they will. And you know the corollary about Murphy was an optimist. Well, negativism and cynicism are classic features of burnout. Just looking at the worst possible construction seems to be a way of coping. And then in contrast to the energetic, lively person who's been usually so interested in new things, new possibilities, losing interest, losing even the sense of curiosity, not really caring very much at all about what happens, and then losing that sense of capacity to do things and becoming increasingly helpless. Actually, there are two phases in burnout. They are opposite to one another, and they're both true. One is the sense of omnipotence, that I can do everything and I'm the only one who can do anything, and if anything's got to be done, I've got to be the one who does it. And again, I can think of a few pastors in my experience who have been like that when they were heading towards burnout. They can't allow the reins to go to anybody else because of their anxiety. And then once that passes, completely flipping to the opposite, not I can do everything, but I can do nothing. I'm helpless, and I'm hopeless, and nobody cares about me anyway, nobody loves me, I think I'll go and dig worms. That kind of attitude. Now that's a pretty dramatic transformation from where people have been to getting to this situation. Burnout is a very powerful word, but I think a very appropriate word. It's the sort of word we use of one of these light globes that goes fuck. It's the sort of word that we use of rockets that have had tremendous surge of power when they're launched. And then after the power has been used, that power source drops away dead into the sea and is no use and is really not any good to anybody. That's like the burned out person, and that's where the picture comes from. So, in addition to those psychological characteristics, we also find that there are a good many physical features which affect people. I just feel tired all the time. I've run out of energy. I just don't seem to be able to cope like I used to. Where's all that bounce that I once had? I'm just too tired to bother. The tension and the anxiety commonly producing experience of headache, together with that, the gut symptoms, gastrointestinal symptoms and disturbances, needing to wonder whether you've got an ulcer, going off to the doctor to check this and that. Nothing really physically wrong, but just discomforts. Inability to sleep properly, lying awake in the middle of the night worrying, a sense of weakness and muscle tension. Not a pretty collection of symptoms. Doctors, general practitioners often worry over these symptoms for weeks and months and have investigations galore because it looks like it ought to be physical, and yet often it isn't. Not really, not primarily. If this goes on and the condition is not recognized, then one can move on to a sense of separation from the self. I wonder if any of you have experienced that. It's a strange term, but I've experienced it just once or twice in my life. Many people experience it quite often. A kind of distancing, almost as if you're standing over there watching yourself, a separating out of the real world from the rest of the world, a disturbing kind of experience for people who have not been accustomed to it. That's a feature that dear old Elijah suffered rather badly, that I mentioned in that 1 Kings 19 passage. If I can just dig it out and read. When God speaks to Elijah and says, "What are you doing here in the cave?" Elijah says, "Lord God Almighty, I've always served you, you alone. But the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down their altars, killed all your prophets. I'm the only one left, and they're trying to kill me. I'm the only faithful one, and they're out to get me." Well, they weren't out to get him. There was one person, the queen, who was out to get him. That's true. But he generalized, "They are out to get me, I'm the only faithful one." That's paranoia. And when you have that feeling that whatever you do isn't good enough and people seem to be after you, then perhaps that's the direction you're going. And then the other feature that I mentioned, the heightened omnipotence, that feeling sometimes that I'm the only one who can do it. Before that happens, we need to ask, how could it get to be like that? If that's the picture of what burnout looks like, what are the circumstances? Let's be aware of those so that we can perhaps do something sensible to avoid them or reduce the probability of this occurring. Emotionally taxing work. Now, most of us will say, "That's me." Yes, I do that. Of course we do. We, most of us, live in emotionally taxing contexts. Several months ago in Adelaide, I was asked to go to a Sunday morning session at a local uniting church to speak to the congregation there. They'd asked for a series of talks on various subjects in their pre-church instruction sessions, and one of them, they said that they wanted something on stress and burnout. Would I go along and speak to them? I said, "Sure, I will. I recognise it as a problem." When I got there, I found it was one of those parishes where the average age was over 60. They were there from the local old folks' home primarily, most of the people, but they'd asked for a talk on stress and burnout. I thought that was fascinating. And when I talked to them and listened to them, I found that many of them were certainly experiencing many features of stress. Not so much burnout, but certainly a lot of stress. So it's not just the obvious people who are going flat out and rushing around who experience stress. Most of us frequently experience what we would call emotionally taxing activities. Those of you who work in a professional context, teachers or social workers or whatever, medical and caring professions, find that part of the problem is that we are often involved with other people's loads as well as our own. the empathy of relationship, the sensitivity to other people's hurt, bearing that over long periods of time, if we don't handle it right, can creep up on us, and that very thing which is the quality feature of our work becomes also the thing that can drag us down. Related to that, what some people call the client-centered orientation. Caring for the person, being about their needs more than our own, putting them first, can have that kind of impact. Then a very important one in our busy society and our society where increasing educational demands are placed upon us. Some have just sensed that we're not as well equipped as we'd wish to be. In my profession, when I came through as a psychology undergraduate, it was usual to have 3 years degree and off you went and practiced as a psychologist. Now the standard is 6 years. And many of us expect to do 11 or 12 years before we're fully qualified. So that people who trained 20, 30 years ago with a 3-year degree feel a bit out of touch and undereducated. Of course they do. I'm thankful I went on after my 3 years because I now know that most of the 3 years I did has got no relevance to today, whatever. Might as well not have done those 3 years for all it means in psychology today. It's all changed. But whichever profession you might happen to be relating to, I think you'll agree the bombardment of higher and higher expectations for educational level makes it difficult for those who come through with lesser education. I'm working with a social worker from our children's hospital at the moment. She's in exactly that dilemma. She trained 15 years ago. She's a super social worker, but she doesn't have the bits of paper. And she's embarrassed when she's supposed to supervise students who are going for those bits of paper. There's another component to that in a moment, which we'll come to. Societal demands, what people expect of you. I was counselling with a pastor just this week. He's been off work for 6 weeks now with burnout, which took him into all kinds of tangles in the parish and an absolute shambles. He's had to be put off work for 12 months. And he thought that he would feel guilty and his people would not value him if he worked less than 80 hours a week. No, he didn't put it in those terms, but when we sat down and added it up, we discovered he was a 7-day-a-week man, and if he was on a time off, he'd go travelling off into the country and visit a congregation here, do something there. We worked there, it was average about 80 hours a week, and he reckoned that was about par for the course. That's crazy. You can't do that. God didn't intend us to do that. The demands either from within ourselves, or from the group we relate to, or society at large, may be so enormous that we begin to fold up. There's another one that many of us wrestle with, uncertainty. There's a great deal of uncertainty in our world. Things are changing, expectations change, we don't quite know where we stand, and if we get into a particular slot in our lives where the uncertainty elements accumulate, that can just be an additional trigger to the whole problem. People are in some state of transition. If you're not sure about the status of your marriage, if you're not sure about where you'll be living next week, if you're not sure about the state of your income, all of those kinds of things can nag and irritate and add to the accumulation of problems that may lead this way. Some of you have the misfortune to live in an organisational structure. I thankfully retired from university life about 5 years ago and abandoned all that university structure nonsense that absolutely prevents you doing most of the things you'd like to do because of the innumerable committees everything has to feed up and down through. Painful way of living. I lived with it for 20 years and now I am my own boss and I can choose to come up here for the day and I don't have to ask permission from anybody. But organisational structure is crippling for many people who would like to get on with the job and find themselves somehow wrestling with all the paperwork that surrounds them. I mentioned the knowledge explosion and the expectation of training and qualifications. The additional problem for most of us who get into any area of professional activity is that the knowledge explosion goes on all around us all the time. It's not just a matter of getting the appropriate qualifications, is it? Have you read the latest book? Are you up with the latest information? Have you heard what so-and-so is saying? Haven't you heard that's out of date now? You ought to be doing this and that. It's overwhelming. Probably in the teaching profession as much as anywhere, where the expectations in terms of content and method and so on are changing very, very rapidly. Very demanding. If you're good at your job, if you're one of those really good, creative, energetic people, there's a fair chance you get added responsibility. You don't just do your job, but somebody expects you to do your job plus, or you get promoted, so you're expected to do more, then you're looking after more people, and so you go up the pyramid of responsibility, and that can be overwhelming, and you end up, in addition, not only doing your own work, but picking up the pieces for others, and you find yourself with work overload, with leadership responsibilities, and probably when you're doing all that and you're overdoing it too much, back home things are not too good, and you'll probably find yourself with personal problems that are irritating and nagging away, making you feel guilty about all sorts of things. That's a fair assortment of problems, isn't it, to put all together? A bit depressing, really. That's where we start, depression. Together with the personality traits which make some people more at risk than others. Many people refer in the literature to what they call type A personalities. That's those busy, energetic, striving people who always go for broke and can't stand being idle ever, but have to be doing three things at a time. The type A personality is a psychological predisposition which makes one that bit more at risk for those who may have a different kind of personality. So there's a fair assortment of traits that we might look for. Well, I'm going to speak for about another 5 minutes, I hope, and then invite you to join in with discussing with me the things that I've mentioned to you. Let's just have a look, first of all, at what we might be able to do about that for people who are suffering the experience or aware that it might be creeping up on them. And then let's look for a few moments preventively at how we can stave off this miserable condition. In order to understand burnout, we really need to know a great deal about it, not only from the person who seems to be suffering from it, but also from family and friends. I mentioned when I started that if you're suffering from burnout, you're likely to be the last person to know. Your spouse or your family generally are much more likely to be aware of it than yourself, or your workmates are more likely to be aware that something is going wrong than yourself. So we really need converging information to determine if this is the problem that somebody is suffering. The focus needs to not be what's wrong with this person, but what can I do to change? Because change is possible. Burnout is a psychological disorder. It's a behaviour problem. It's the way you cope with the world, and I believe that we can change the ways we believe, that we behave. If we can't, then there's something strangely wrong with what we're taught in Scripture. We are taught that change is possible. So, if it is possible to bring about changes, let's look at a few of the more useful ones. Some people are very bad at setting goals and priorities. Some people have about 20 number one priorities in their lives. And if you ask them to write down, what is your number one priority? It's very difficult. Well, there's my spouse, there's my children, there's my job, there's God. And all kinds of things will come in. Now, which is first? Well, I'm not sure. Be a pretty valuable exercise for you sometime, just to sit down and with a piece of paper say, what is my ordering of priorities? And then look at the amount of time you spend in those areas and discover whether the time you spend matches the priority that you think you've got. If you think God is the most important figure in your life, but you actually spend 30 out of 40 waking hours a week sitting in front of the television, you just might have somehow got it all mixed up. Look to Philippians then, whose God is their telly. You need to be very careful to ensure that you allocate time wisely. Goals and priorities. In order to do that, one of the hardest words in our language for people who really care and are committed and are energetic is the ability to say no. Will you join this committee? Will you do that activity? Can you come and help us with that? Can you provide a plate for that? Can you attend that meeting? You know the pattern? And you feel guilty if you say no? It's not an invitation. It feels like a command. The expectation that you'll be there. Very hard for many of us to say no. And not be apologetic. Not, oh, I'm sorry, I'd like to, but I can't. Doesn't need to be that. No. No, I'm not available. No, I have other priorities. No, it doesn't fit in with my schedule. And to be quite clear-cut about it is a way to survive. If you're one of those people who's wanted, in 10 different places at once. I remember once after church on a Sunday morning, a young fellow came up to me. He was a student. He was one of those beautifully shiny black Africans. I don't remember, I think it was from Kenya. He'd recently come over. He was a glowing, alive Christian guy. He was a lovely fellow. I'd seen him a few times at church. And he beetled up to me after church and he grabbed me in that sort of African enthusiasm way. "The Lord has told me," he said, "that you are to be at our Christian fellowship next Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock to speak on something or other." So I dug out my diary and I said, "That's a funny thing, you know. The Lord has never asked me to be in two places once before. I'm already committed somewhere else." And I didn't like the way his face fell. You know, Christians are pretty good at that sometimes, huh? Blackmail, I call it. And that's not an intended pun, but it might be wrong. Creative expansion is saying to the person who's so focused on work and commitments and responsibilities, how about you do something else for a while? Not adding to the load, but dropping off a few of those things that seemed terribly important and just changing gear and looking creatively to alternatives. Things you would have loved to have done if you'd had the time. Please do them before it's too late. I've got dossiers here on people who have not made the change and it has become too late and they have died to tell the tale. You can die of this condition if you don't arrest it, and then it is too late to look creatively and say, "I really will enjoy doing something because I enjoy doing it," and not feel guilty about it. Don't know if you feel okay about a word like relaxation. I'm reading an awful lot of literature in psychology which suggests that things like relaxation and meditation are naughty words that we shouldn't use in Christian circles. So let me be quite clear that I mean things which are entirely consistent with Christian teaching. To have some time out from the pressure, to go for a walk, to contemplate, to look at the leaves, to discover the beauty of God's creation. Things like that. Just to be away from the pressures. I have a friend who's a pastor in Adelaide who for years did this run-around thing and was out at meetings every night. He had three children and a beautiful wife, but he very rarely saw them. Busy all the weekend with his youth groups and out every evening. And eventually got cancer. And the cancer really told him he'd have to make some reconstruction to his life. And he gave me a bit of advice that I found very helpful when I once phoned him up and asked if he would come to speak for something or other that I was organising. He looked at his diary, he said, "Well, that evening I'm doing nothing." So I said, "Oh, great, so you can come." He said, "No, that evening I'm doing nothing." And I thought about that, and I thought, there's wisdom. He's learned something, and I have learned the same. There are some evenings when I am not available. Mondays at home, I am not available for consultations. If the phone rings, it will be dealt with by my answer machine. And I'm sorry if the person's going to commit suicide or whatever it is they were planning to do, I have to do it without me. I will not be invaded on in the way I used to allow myself to be, quite mercilessly. So I allow some times out. Many of us don't get enough exercise. We're so busy doing good things, we don't have time for that area of our lives. I think as a society we're learning more about the value of that, but many Christians are still to catch up on that. Let me encourage you to believe that exercise is a good thing, that we should be looking after our bodies physically. Vacationing? Well, I like coming up to Queensland, but that's not the only way to get a vacation. I always enjoy my trips up here, especially even further north. But the theory there is that you can vacation in fantasy also. And I find I can do that too. Way back in Adelaide, I can have a little picture of Port Douglas in my mind and feel very good. And it's useful sometimes just to take time out and reflect on some of those great experiences you've had. Maybe the great spiritual experiences, physical experiences, experiences with friends, holidays, I don't care. But savour them again. And you'll often find that the feeling comes back and it's very healthy. I hope you have a sense of humour. It can enable you to ride over many of the difficult things. We need a sense of humour. I'm sure Jesus had a sense of humour, and I find it a great value at many, many occasions. And sometimes it's necessary to look at your work schedule and decide, this is not what I'm going to go on doing. This is not the kind of work for me. Some people are at risk. We used to think of people starting work around the age of between 15 and 25 and staying in the same job year after year after year. I can recall that if one was called to be a missionary, you were supposed to go out to the field and stay till you dropped. 20, 30, 50, 60 years. And if you came back sooner than that, you'd failed. But that isn't the way of it anymore, thankfully, I'd say. We're finding that increasingly people are segmenting their adult lives. Up to about 10 years is much more the common pattern these days for people's work schedules. They work at a particular job for 10 years, retrain and retool and do another 10, and then another 10, and so on. Not at all uncommon. And often quite major shifts. People going as missionaries will very commonly go for 2 terms and say, that's it. And that's accepted as okay now, whereas it wasn't before. People used to go and become pastors, clergymen and the like, and the thought was that they would be in that forever and a day, and that's still fairly strongly the case. But not necessarily. And some, after 10 or 20 years, are moving sideways and doing something else. Still dedicated Christians, but redeploying their energies. And for some of us, that's a wise move, because the pressures of a particular kind of life may be such that we're very much at risk from burnout. What can we do? We need to sometimes look at the relationship within a family and restructure things so the family is not all the time left out. Pastors' kids, you know the problem? They always complain that dad's available to everybody else but themselves. I used to worship in the same church as Dean Lance Shilton, who's now Dean of Sydney, and his favourite line was about his daughter saying, Mummy, who's that man who comes home and kisses you and smacks me? And the answer is, that's your daddy. And he had good reason to tell that tale, because he lived in a city parish in North Terrace in Adelaide, and he was on call far too much. And many pastors say that it has bad repercussions for their family life, and it happens in other jobs too. Peer group support. We need one another. It's one of the strengths of being a Christian, surely, that we can draw on brothers and sisters to support us when we're having heavy times. We can, but some of us are too proud to do it at the moment when we ought to. We'll encourage others to do it, but find it very hard to do it ourselves. And then, thirdly, to realistically appraise the setting in which you find yourself. If you're trying to do something which is impossible within the current framework, you're going to get awfully disappointed and frustrated. The sooner you realise that it can't be done, the better. Now, that may mean organisational change, or it may mean you reappraise your goals, or it may mean you go somewhere else, a range of options. But don't go on trying to achieve what is impossible. I have never seen a crocodile fly, and I don't expect to, because it isn't made that way. And some of us try to be like that. We try to do the impossible and then wonder why it's so difficult. So, those are some of the things that we can do by way of intervention when somebody is really in strife. Let me add again from 1 Kings 19 before I move on to prevention, that probably the most valuable thing I've discovered in working with people with burnout is spelled out for us in that story of Elijah. So I can find the relevant verse. Right up at the beginning of the story. He lay under the tree. He fell asleep. An angel touched him and said, wake and eat. And he looked around and saw a loaf of bread and a jar of water near his head. He ate and drank. Lay down again, and then the Lord's angel returned and woke him a second time, get up and eat. And he did, and Elijah got up and ate and drank, and the food gave him enough strength to walk 40 days to Sinai, the holy mountain. He went into a cave to spend the night. He was totally looked after. He didn't have any responsibilities, even for cooking his meals or finding the food. He went away for 40 days and 40 nights, which I understand to mean a long time in Scripture. When I'm working with people, I take that fairly literally for convenience and say no less than 6 weeks off work if you want to survive. and preferably 6 weeks away from everything that you've been associated with. Go off into a cave, go off into a corner, go off 1,000 miles from here. Whatever you can do, get as far away from commitments and responsibilities as you possibly can. And spend time with God. Because that's the other theme that runs right through that story. He listened to God speaking to him in a way that perhaps he had not been doing. And eventually, when he'd listened to God, then, after a couple of conversations, we find at the end of the story, then the Lord said, "Return to the wilderness near Damascus and anoint Hazael king of Syria." In other words, back to business. You've done what needed to be done. You're an okay servant of God again. Get on with doing what you were scheduled to do. And I think we all need to recognize that there are times for us to withdraw from the pressures so that we can come back and do an even better job. We don't have to feel guilty about taking that kind of time out. If we don't choose to take that time out, we'll find we have to because we've become so ill that we cannot cope. Prevention is better than cure. It can be prevented. And here's a series of propositions which run down to 12, which I've borrowed from Professor Newt Maloney, who's Professor of Psychology in Fuller Seminary. He says, and I'll just run through them quickly in the hopes of allowing you a few minutes to talk about this. One, if it is anticipated, that is, if you can see the writing on the wall, do something before it's too late. If lifelong assignments are avoided, I mentioned that perhaps you see your adult life in segments rather than stretching off into the indefinite future. It's safer and healthier to see shorter term goals. If busyness is not used as an antidote to insecurity, a lot of us get busy because we're anxious. We ought to be busy because there's something to be done and then stop, not be allaying our intrinsic anxieties. If success is intrinsically defined, that is, success is something which we recognize before God is a good thing to have done, not all the time trying to please A, B or C. Please the boss, please the wife, the husband, please someone out there. That's not the way to identify success. You're going to run a treadmill if your success criterion is somebody else's approval. If negotiation of one's job is used to avoid excessive responsibility, learn and regularly practice a relaxation technique. Simply breathing quietly and peaceably and allowing the Lord to speak to you in a quiet, relaxed frame of mind can be very helpful, especially last thing at night. Instead of watching telly till you go to bed and spend 5 minutes just meditating quietly and peaceably and breathing, and I'd be surprised if you have a sleep problem. Get regular exercise, get adequate sleep, be flexible as opposed to that rigidity that I mentioned. In other words, creative alternatives to what you're doing. Slow down. I'll say it again on the tape in a slow voice. Slow down. Because many of us are guilty of hurry sickness. God is never in a hurry. Not quite true, I suppose. Sometimes he is. I heard a story from our Bible college recently about a young guy. Maybe you've heard the story. It wasn't original. A guy who was said to sign in for Bible college. He was so clever, he thought he could do the whole thing in 3 months. It was supposed to be a 3-year course. And he went to the principal. He said, "I don't think I need 3 years. I only need 3 months. I know most of it." Principal said, "Well, I think perhaps you ought to go along with the rest and do the 3 years." After about a couple of months, he was really rather keen that perhaps the student did only spend 3 months. So he had him back into his office. He said, "Do you still think that?" And the chap said, "Yes, I think 3 months will be enough for me, thank you very much." So the principal said, "Well, okay, I have come to the point where I agree with you. My observation is that God takes a long time to grow trees, but he only takes a short time to grow melons." And he left. Learn constructive ways of handling anger. Anger is one of the underlying currents of energy that commonly fuels burnout and those type A, rushing, bustling people. So we need to come realistically to terms with our own anger. Spend a lot of time on that, but I won't. Pay attention to the little hassles. Often it's not the big things that defeat you, it's the little things. lots and lots of them can be most irritating. They've done some studies in the police force just recently which show that exact point. It's not the big shootouts, the Hoddle Street massacre kind of thing that really get to the police. It's the paperwork and the niggles and the repeated silly little things that are giving police ulcers and giving them burnout. Develop good empathy in your care of others. That's that being aware of other people's needs and relating to them in a helpful way. Focus on the essentials and don't get hooked up in all the trivia and non-essential things. Shed the bits which don't have to be done if you're getting overwhelmed. Keep in touch with reality, and again, beware of those unrealistic goals. Don't set yourself impossible targets. I worked with a girl who's now in her early 30s, not long ago, who went through her high school, she went to a church school, and then went into university, and she cracked up in university. And I asked her about her high school experience, and she said she'd been a disappointment to her parents, both of whom were medical practitioners, and I asked why. And she said, I was only equal ducks of my school. A bit hard to live up to, isn't it? And she cracked. An unrealistic goal she was being set or setting for herself. Avoid helplessness through exercising control with faith. Helplessness is one of the most grindingly difficult things to live with. We are not helpless if we are Christians. We have both help and hope. And if you can't resolve a major conflict, leave it. And don't be afraid to seek professional help when you need it, either with the conflict or with the accumulation of things that's called burnout. It can be necessary to go and ask for help. So there's 12 propositions that might be useful. And I've come to that point with, I think, about 4 or 5 minutes left in the hope that you might care to talk about that before we take a break. Over to you.
This fellow up from Melbourne, 30 years in the teaching game, state system, extremely conscientious, and we were talking about making a move, and he said, oh, I wish I had have come to Queensland a few years ago. And I said, well, why didn't you? And he said, well, I'm caught in the superannuation trap. And I wonder if you want to reflect on what sort of advice or what do you say to someone who feels that they're in a situation where they're trapped in there for reasons of family security and all of those sort of financial matters, plus being a very conscientious person and feeling a bit hidebound by what he finds to be organisational problems in his school system.
Isn't that a problem? I'm not sure that I can give you any general principle. I can reflect from personal experience of something that happened with me 5 years ago and again this week that I think bears on that. 5 years ago, I was in exactly that situation, deciding it was time to move from the university, that it seemed that God was telling me to set up a Christian psychological practice, and when I looked at it, the superannuation implications were appalling. I was going to effectively lose half my superannuation, and you don't do that lightly, especially when you've got 4 children. So I had to think very hard about that, and really the question is, where do your priorities lie? Now, I came to the conclusion my priorities were not on a big superannuation payout, but I would make the move that needed to be made anyway and leave the rest to God. Now, after I'd made that decision, and I had a few more months around the university, I must have had several dozen people came up to me around the campus and said, I wish I'd dared make the move you've made. Oh, I do envy you. People of my age and older stuck in the superannuation trap. And I realised just how many people are actually locked into this in the public service and many other settings. People who are just tied to something they no longer enjoy because they think somehow they've got to hang in for the money. Now, I'm delighted I made that move. Not least because one of the people who said that to me, also a clinical psychologist like myself, chose at the same time not to make that move but to hang in there with the system. And I was speaking to him this week. I saw him on campus when I was up at the library. And he looks very dismal. He said, I've got to sweat it out for another 3 years now. I said, do you really have to? He said, well, yeah, I'm afraid so. You see, about 3 years ago, I took my superannuation into my possession like we got the opportunity to, and I invested it. And last October, and I've got nothing. I've got to hang in there for the little bit that I'm now going to get. So I thought, well, there you are. He stayed for it, and what did he get? And I reckon it's a matter of looking at the priorities. Yes, can I make two observations about the fact you're involved with other people who hang upon your involvement and you're each sort of mutually interdependent on one another? That happens in many settings, doesn't it? You'd feel guilty at backing off from your responsibilities a bit? I think there are two things to say. One is that we, all of us, model on others. And if they see you as super conscientious, they feel they've got to do the same. The new ones coming into the system have got to do the same. And you each reinforce one another to the point that you all overdo it. And the expectations just go up and up and up to match your intensity of action. And in fact, you are self-defeating to everybody at that point. And a Christian might be a good person to set the lead at de-escalating. And the second thing I'd say is, if you find yourself in that trap, ask where they will be if next week you have burnout, which puts you out of circulation for 12 months, and they've got to carry that work that you were doing for that period of time. Are you perhaps putting another two or three at risk? So you've got a domino effect. So someone's got to do some hard thinking and say, this is not the way to go. We are killing ourselves. And I think that's a very responsible thing to do. And it may mean going to the employer and either saying, we've got to have more staff, and you know the hollow laugh that comes for that, or alternatively saying, we've got to restructure the work situation so that we do not defeat ourselves in what we're seeking to do. One more question, otherwise the tape will run out on us. I think it's got about another 30 seconds to go. Yes, it's a miserable time for everybody. It is one that cannot be rushed. The minimum, in my view, would be 3 months out of circulation, but up to a year, depending on what's happened. It is commonly a time of re-evaluating priorities, usually doing virtually nothing for at least 3 months, then saying, is this the work I'm going to go back into, or have I now got to actually look to a quite different area of work? There may be a planning towards retraining, therefore, over some months to be able to do a different kind of work. And there needs also for the Christian, I believe, to be a real restructuring of spiritual priorities and spending time with God to say, you know, how did this happen to me and how can I make sure this does not happen again so that I become overcommitted? Because that's usually a core feature of it. So there are a number of tasks to be undertaken within that period of time out of the area of responsibility while you've got freedom to choose and think again. But for the first 3 months or so, not making any plans or any significant decisions at all, just surviving. And that will most often be how people feel that it's got to be. They're depressed, they're angry, they feel let down, they can't stand the thought of God, etc., etc. So there's nothing to be done but hang in, and for the family to hang in for about 3 months, and then people will begin to be able to make small decisions and restructure their lifestyle.